Hello out there in Na'ala land. We begin again our class today, which is Lili Nishmas Rachaleah Bas Rav Chaim Tzvi, Alei Lashom Shrevi Lichtige Gan Eden. We want to thank all those people responsible for Na'ala, of course, our big boss, Reb Tzipi Klaver, who's the brains behind everything, and the great Reichman family, and our greatest studio technician, Mrs. Levy Bamzer, who's always here with a smile on her face and professional work. Okay, today is our class devoted to Ahavas Chinam, which we can also subtitle Teller's Peace Plan. Not to be confused with a peace plan with murderous neighbors, but among ourselves to avoid strife, machloket, argumentation. And we'll see, time permitting, how far we go. We have several steps to this peace plan in no particular order. Step number one, found in the words of the Chafetz Chaim in his great essay, Chafetz Chaim, where is it? I think the essay is called Chafetz Chaim Shmir Saloshin. And this is all but buried. You have to look carefully to see this. It's such an important point. And Kedarko, he just sticks it in. He writes the following. He writes that what happens if you get into an argument with someone, you're right, and the other person is wrong. Isn't it amazing how often this happens? If I could just interrupt for 1 second to call the Na'ala staff, and we could... Okay. I tried, but they're very busy doing other things in this very, very busy studio. Back to, you get into an argument with someone, you're right, and the other person is wrong. What should you do? Writes Chafetz Chaim, you should give in, tell God the problem, explain the situation, and he'll take care of you. I repeat that. You're right, and the other person is wrong. What should you do? Give in, tell God the problem, explain the sitch, and he'll take care of you. And he gives the following analogy. A father's giving supper to his children, gives everyone an eighth of chicken, American audience, a quarter of chicken, and Beryl takes Shmerel's piece of chicken in front of all the siblings, in front of Peril, in front of Cheryl. And you all know how it is, especially if you're a parent. My piece of chicken, no, it's my piece of grease and bones and fighting. At this point, you're not interested in justice because Shmerel goes to his father and says, one of my siblings took my supper. Very clever boy. He says, there's no point in arguing. Tells his father. Now, what do? You don't get, grease and bones. So what do? Give everyone a patch and tell everyone to be quiet. That's the usual justice. Write the Chafetz Chaim, give in, tell God the problem, explain the situation. That's Chafetz Chaim's analogy. Now, if this example sounds a little bit antiquated, allow me to share with you a more contemporaneous example. As some of you are aware, we've been blessed with a large family, and one of my responsibilities at home, when I'm home, is giving kids breakfast in the morning. Now, I've developed a system how to give a lot of kids breakfast in a short amount of time. I've yet to acquire a patent for this, but unhumbly, it is deserving. So what do? I serve them all cornflakes. Put out the bowls. Then put in the cornflakes. New box. New box. New box. New box. New box. Put in the spoons. And then I put in the milk. New bag. In Israel, it's bags. So I get my muscles in the morning. Every morning, 8 bags of milk from the Makolet. 8 liters. Bag, 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 bag. And 8 minutes later, out the door. One of my rules, like all of my rules, they're all very vehemently ignored. One of my rules is you're not allowed to talk during breakfast. I mean, of course, breakfast in my house sounds like the runway at Fort Worth Dallas Airport. But in any event, so I told them, no one's allowed to talk. So one winter, several years ago, I decided to record the kids' reaction during breakfast in no chronological order. The first kid said, I love when they give me a religious argument. First kid said, there isn't enough cereal in the bowl for a bracha achrona. Second kid said that she wants chocolate milk with her cornflakes. Third kid said, if she gets chocolate milk, I want chocolate milk. Fourth kid said that he wants his, how do you do this? Fourth kid said that he wants the cereal, he wants pancakes instead of cornflakes. As if I know how to make it. 7:15 in the morning, pancakes instead of cornflakes. Fifth kid said that she wants her cereal more crispified and not so sogified. Sixth kid said that she wants it more sogified and not so crispified. So you might say, why don't you just switch the bowls? Oh, no. You never switch the bowls. Switch the bowls means an automatic cornflake fight. Seventh kid... One day this kid will slay me. He always knows how to ask an existential question when there's no time. Seventh kid is looking at the cornflake and he says, Why do they call it cornflakes? Does it look like corn? Eighth kid, her tooth fell out in the bowl. Couldn't find it, turned the bowl upside down. Couldn't find her turning all the bowls upside down. Ninth kid said that he can't stand the fuzz in the bottom of the box. You know, the granules on the bottom. Tenth kid said, she dafka likes the fuzz in the bottom of the box. Why did I have to start a new box on her when she likes the fuzz in the bottom of the box? Tenth kid said that his brother picked his nose, put on a cornflake, and dropped it in his bowl. 11, 12, 13, no originality here, said they want the cornflakes in a baby bottle. So I tried to explain to them, it gets in a baby bottle, it's stuck in the nipple, can't come out. They start crying, he starts crying, she starts crying, what can I tell you? And Baruch Hashem, little kids, I don't give breakfast to yet. But I don't care if, you know, I don't care if one kid would say to me, I don't care if it's sagafied or crispified or with chocolate milk or without chocolate milk, I would give them that kiss on the head and give them doubles. And that's precisely what the Chofetz Chaim is writing. Give in, tell God the problem, explain the situation, and our Father will give you doubles. For who is our Father, if not our Father in heaven? And He loves when we're together, and He despises when we argue. So give in, and our Father will give you doubles. That's the first step in our peace plan. Second step in our peace plan, and here again we turn to the wonderful library of Na'ale. Don't go away. Whoa. Yes. There isn't a studio on the face of this earth as equipped as the Na'ale library. Famous Gemara and Ksuvos. Daf. Here's a rule. Never say famous unless you find them Amud right away. And yes, indeed, that famous Gemara in Ksuvos, Daf Tes Zayin Amud Beis. Zok the Gemara. Tanu Rabban and the rabbis have taught. Keitz merakdim lifnei akala. How does one dance before the bride? Zok Rashi ma omrim lefaneha. The question is not do you do the boogie woogie or the foxtrot or the electric staircase or slide or whatever it is, but rather, what do you say to the groom about the bride? As I understand it, not like they had these long, protracted courtships, 2 dates, 3 dates, and those days there's no time to mess around. Met the girl, went on the chuppah, and shalom a Yisrael. So here he is, standing on the chuppah, she's marching down, and he's thinking to himself, ay, what have I done to myself? Having a major anxiety attack, thus frekt the Gemara. That is the Gemara. How do you compliment the bride to the groom to assuage his frazzled nerves? How are you going to compliment her external beauty to put him at ease? That's the Gemara's question. Beshamay Omrim Beshamay says, Kala Kamoshi. You tell exactly and precisely the way it is. You call it the way it is. Beautiful, beautiful. Looks like the back of a naked bus. Back of the bus. Beis Hillel disputes and says, Omrim Kala No, no matter what you say, she is a beautiful and a gracious bride. And these words in Aramaic are deliciously ambiguous, like you can say in English, a beautiful person, which connotes more character than externals. Ask Beis Hillel, you, Beis Hillel, you, one who says no matter what, beautiful and gracious, let me ask you a question. And he says, Beis Shammai, Osuma, if she would be horrifically, offensively, objectively ugly, Ichsa, Pichsa. Would you also say Kala Noa V'Chasuda? You'd also say beautiful. It says in the Torah Midvar Sheker, you have to avoid speaking false. How in the world can you warrant? How can you license saying beautiful and gracious if she objectively is horrifically ichsa, horrible, horribly, offensively ugly? Answer is Beis Hillel Beis Shammai. Armelam Beis Hillel Beis Shammai. Such a great Gemara. How do you answer a question with a question? L'divreichem. Let me ask you a question. According to your opinion, if someone would buy a bad purchase in the marketplace, would you extol it or would you denigrate it? Would you praise it or would you belittle it? For example, let's take an example. Fagi is flying back from Israel after a year of seminary. She's flying back to America. She goes to the airport. During the flight, she wanted to write a letter and she forgot to bring a pen. So she's just about to go through passport control in Ben Gurion Airport. She's in a little stationery store. She walks inside. Proprietor sees her walk in. He says, tell me, he says, Tagidli. Tagidli. At turistit, are you a tourist? And Vedi says, Tourist. How did you know? He said, I'm an observant Jew, and I noticed these things. He said, yes, I am. He said, wow, if you're a tourist, I'm going to give you a special deal. I love tourists. I'm going to give you a very, very special deal. Such as, but one condition. Do you have a credit card? Yes, I do. If you have a credit card, I'm going to give you a special deal. Provide a contingent. You don't tell anyone else. It's for you and all you and no one else. You may not, shall not tell anyone. Okay, okay. She gets all, everyone loves a bargain. Okay, what would you like to buy? I want to buy a pen. Okay, you see this pen over here? For you and only you, just 25,000 shekel. Now, to tell the truth, Fagi's a bit confused. So confused, I called this Funkuzd. Because prior to coming to Israel, she was in Italy, where the prices are so inflated, where you pay 38,000 lira for a soft drink and 42,000 lira to get onto a bus. 25,000 shekel sounded like a bargain. He said, and she said, okay. She hands her the credit card. She hands him the credit card. He puts it through the machine. And she walks out. Now, don't forget, he told her, don't tell her. Oh, mum's the word. I won't say a word. She's so excited. She got a bargain. She goes through passport control, the point of no return. She has this big smile on her face. Now, you all know how it is when you... You ever see someone walking on the street with a big smile on their face? They look totally moronic and basilic and idiotic. And you go, hey, Faggy, why are you so happy? And she goes, I can't tell you. What do you mean you can't tell me? I can't tell you. Why? I'm your best friend. If I tell you why I'm happy, you'll be jealous. No, I'm jealous. I'm your friend. Please? No, I can't. I promise. I'll be your best friend and a happy camper. Said, okay. See this pen over here? I got it for a bargain. How much did you pay? He goes, oh, no. Paid only 25,000 shekel. Now, when you hear Fagi say this, what should you do? I'm waiting for your answer. What should you do? So if you are a disciple of Shammai, you'll say, whoa, you got really ripped off. But if you're a disciple of Hillel, now you might say to her, next time you get a bargain like this, take me along. And this way you can set her straight. But what is to become is already too late. She already went through passport control. She can't go back. That's Basil's question. He's already standing on the chuppah. The invitations went out. What is to be accomplished? Here the Gemara is famous conclusion. You say should be pleasing to the creations. Not hurtful, not spiteful, not gratuitous, but pleasing. What an important step for peace. People do this all the time. People say things which are so hurtful and spiteful. My dear son-in-law pointed out such a wonderful thing. He said, the first thing people say, when if you haven't seen someone for a long time, you say, you know, you're gaining weight. You're turning gray. Everyone in the world has a modicum of vanity. No one wants to hear they're becoming heavy. No one wants to hear they're turning gray. No one wants to hear any drawback. It's the first thing people say when you say should be pleasing, not hurtful, not spiteful. Your roommate in seminary, or your roommate in your dorm apartment on the west side, wherever you live, your roommate is going out at night, taxi is honking. She's stepping out to him and says, how do I look? You go, oh. Obviously, she's not going to change the taxi's honking. All she's doing is fishing for a compliment. Say a nice word. Charming, attractive, cute. Say something nice. It's such an easy step for peace. Say a pleasant word, a step for peace. My neighbor and my cousin, it's the same person, my cousin is my neighbor, her kitchen cabinets are the color you would associate more with a racing car than you would with a kitchen cabinet. So someone said that you must come from a certain ethnic group because you have this color kitchen cabinet. She was so offended that she decided she was not going to step back into the kitchen, which is a very impractical thing when you have a family, because she was so embarrassed from her kitchen cabinets. In the end, she had them reformicified, which cost her hundreds of shekel. Actually, thousands of shekel. All because of this one gratuitous statement by a person that wasn't thinking. He didn't understand what you say should be pleasing to the creations. One last example. This is many, many, many years ago. I just bought my first scooter. So we're talking about 26 years ago. Just bought my first scooter. And it was outside, parked in the sun, gleaming, glistening, this brand new scooter. There's a knock on the door. A fellow standing there, he looks like Tisha B'Av. He is so disenchanted, crestfallen, melancholy. He asked me, is that your scooter outside? I said, yes, it is. I'm very proud of it, brand new. He said, well, maybe you can help me get mine started. And I don't know, the first thing all I know is you put in the key and you go. But I saw the guy look so depressed, he said, I'll try. And so as we're walking down the stairs to go to his scooter, he told me he just bought a scooter at a bargain because he works in Weizmann in Rehovot. A fellow had to fly overseas and he was liquidating and he sold his possessions at a bargain. And they said, how much did you pay for it? He told me what was equivalent of about $600. Now, I had bought at the time what was the best scooter for what was $1,200. And $1,200 was something you could buy the same scooter in America for probably under $350. So $600 for a secondhand scooter sounded very, very high, very steep. I said, what model is it? I mean, what year is it? Now, again, this is 22 years ago. He said, 1969. That's still, whoa, that was 11, 12 years old already, and to pay $600. So I go outside and I see this piece of junk, and I'm huffing and puffing and trying to get a kickstart going. I can't get the engine to move. And I was basically convinced that if you were to drop in a new engine, I don't know stuff, you'd get the thing to move. And I thought to myself, he paid $600. Maybe if he'd be lucky, he could junk the parts for $20, $25. He says, tell me, what do you say? What do you think? What do you think? My wife thinks I'm a fool for having bought this thing. You think I'm a fool? And I said to him, you know, I don't know much about scooters. I don't know much about price. All I can tell you is, look at my scooter over here, glinting in the sun. It is just announcing from the rooftops, come steal me. But look at yours. It is such value. You can sleep at night, not worried someone's going to rip it off, someone's going to steal it. It is, I think that's worth something. I saw he looked so relaxed, so relieved from that statement. He was foolish, but who has to tell him that? Say something pleasant. An important step for peace. Okay, our third step on peace is, again, from the words of Chafetz Chaim. He writes the following. It is a wise idea to establish a peace fund, a Keren Shalom. And he advises, at the beginning of the year, earmark money for peace. Now, I know you're hearing this before 3 weeks. We're not at the beginning of the year. We're closing in at the end of the year, end of the Jewish year. But it doesn't matter. This part, I can carry the Chafetz Chaim's policy a little bit further. Earmark money for peace. And this way, there is no one who wants to lose money. However, if you look at peace as a mitzvah, we're accustomed to spending money on mitzvot. We're not happy about it, but we spend money on davening minim, on kosher meat, on Jewish education, on tefillin. The costs of Jewish lifestyle are endless. We may not be happy about it, but we're accustomed to it. Shalom is an important mitzvah. Earmark money for peace. And that way, the next time there's an argument, it's not coming out. Because here's the rule. There are so many arguments that could be avoided that could be avoided through money. So therefore, just take the money out of your peace fund, and this way you don't feel it's coming out of your pocket. Or if you're from England, coming out of your pocket. Because it's already allocated for Shalom. Rav Shlomo Hyman, Zichron Lebracha, was the great Gedolim of America, Talmud from Europe, if I'm not mistaken, Talmud of Baruch Be'er, from the Kamas Yeshiva. He comes to America as a Roshiva in Tar Vidas. Actually, Shlomo Hyman was a interesting story, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but he was a tremendous gadol, and Rav Baruch Be'er, the Talmud Muvak of Rav Chaim Brisker, was chalashing to have him for a son-in-law. So the story was told to me as he went out. Now, Rav Baruch Be'er's daughter, I'm sure, was an extremely beautiful person in character, but externally she was not very attractive. She was you might even say, remarkably, not yet attractive, albeit, I'm sure, a beautiful person. And Rav Baruch Be'er goes out with her, they get engaged, and then he calls off the engagement. Rav Baruch Be'er calls him in, he says, why'd you call it off for? He said, I found I couldn't live with the externals. Baruch Be'er said, only a Litvak could say this, he said, what is this, an esrog? You don't need an esrog, you need to have beautiful. What does it have to do with a wife? What's he does? It's not an esrog. Okay, so anyway, so Rav Shlomo Hyman came to America, came to Roshiva in Tar Vidas, and I assume he lived in Williamsburg, because that's where Yeshiva is located. And in the summer, like many people in New York City, are very anxious to get a hot summer in the city, anxious to go up to the country, to the Catskill Mountains. So I said, I want to go up to the country. He said to Herzog Chaim, I have no problem going on vacation, provide a contingent that we can afford it. As long as we can afford it, I'll go. I'm not going to borrow money to go on vacation. So the Rebbetzin took out pen and paper, and she recorded every expense from movers to renting the bungalow to whatever they had to buy for the bungalow. She worked on pen and paper, and it was just enough. They could just, to the last penny, just afford it. Rabbi Shlomo Haim looked at the list and said, I'm very sorry, but you didn't allocate any money for Shalom. Because invariably, I know those of you familiar with bungalows will have a hard time relating to this, but in the old days, a bungalow meant there were three, maybe even more families that would share a bungalow and have a common kitchen. He said, invariably, if there are three families sharing a common kitchen, they're going to have arguments. Why are you taking my mayonnaise? And who these are my eggs? And you're arguing. So just, I'm going to allocate. If there's no money allocated for Shalom, I don't want to lose a vacation. I don't want to lose a good time in the summer over arguments that could be avoided through a peace fund. We have to allocate money for peace. And I spoke about this clearly 20 years ago in Brooklyn in the shul of Rabbi Ralbag. If I hope I'm saying the name correctly, Ralbag sitz on a Beis Din, which is Masada Gittin. He said, if people would know this, that I'd be put out of business. So many arguments. When he heard it, he just stood on his feet and he said, so many arguments could be avoided just by allocating money and avoiding the argument. Okay, we've already done three steps in our peace plan. And we'll come to our concluding step. Let's just see. Yeah, I'm sorry. We'll give you two penultimately. Penultimately, there's a mitzvah in the Torah called Lo sisayiv mitzri kiger hayisa ba'artzo, or if you prefer, Lo tita'ev mitzri kiger hayita ba'artzo. You may not despise an Egyptian, for you were once strangers in their land. What does that mean? When we were desperate and we were in Egypt, the Egyptians provided for the roof of our heads. And therefore, we can't hate them. Now, is there a mitzvah every single day to remember going out of Egypt and how we suffered in Egypt? Yes, there is. Is there a mitzvah on a yearly basis to tell of the story how we suffered in Egypt and how we were persecuted and prosecuted? Yes, there is. We have to remember how they afflicted us and how we suffered, and yet, we may not despise them because when we were desperate, they provided a roof over our heads. Let's dive into it. So here's a real simple Kal V'chomer. Even if you never went to yeshiva, and if you don't have a grub of thumb, simple Kal V'chomer, simple calculation. If you're not allowed to hate an Egyptian who persecuted and prosecuted and afflicted and tortured, how much more so may you not hate your fellow Jew who doesn't do you a favor? What happens if you ask your friend for a favor, your neighbor for a favor, and they refuse? And once they refuse, you think to yourself, what a chutzpah. They're refusing me a favor, they couldn't do me a favor, and a whole life of Beishakov education flashed for your heads, and a whole life of what you've learned flashed for your heads, they can't do me a favor. But you don't know the whole story. Maybe, you know, I heard this example from Reb Tzin Samet. You know, someone comes to your house and says, may I borrow a chair? Neighbor says, no. You need a chair. They can't afford to lend you a chair. But what you don't know is maybe they know that when you borrow things, it takes you a long time to return them. And so therefore, what they want to do is they have chairs buried in their basement, not doing anything. They want to go down to the basement, climb up to the attic, pull out this chair, and they're going to give you the chair. But right now, to take a chair from the living room, which they need and they use every day, or a chair from the kitchen they use every day, that they don't want to give you. But they're going to give you a chair which you can have long term. You know the story. And that's our segue to our final step to avoiding argument and promoting peace. Let's say one more time. The last one is that a simple Kal V'chomer. Here's an example. Let's say every single Tuesday night at 8 o'clock you go to aerobics, and at 7:45 your friend Chani picks you up. So now it's after Yontif and you're feeling, whoops. Maybe you are feeling, whoops, that was for my glasses. It's after Yontif and you're taking up the whole Na'ala screen because you're very, very heavy. And you all the time you're saying to yourself, it doesn't matter, after Yontif I have aerobics and I'm going to sweat it off and work it off and kickbox it off. And you're all excited. So it's now Tuesday night and you've been waiting all psyched up. You're going to go to aerobics, 7:45. Chani calls you up, said, I'm so sorry, I met my friend Pina in the street, I'm giving her a ride, sorry. Click. And you think to yourself, whoa, what a creep. All week long I was looking forward to, how could she stick me like this? Then the approach should be, Chani doesn't owe you anything. For over a year she's been trying to do every single week. And all of a sudden, all the favors that she's done are just forgotten, and you focus on the bad and don't think about the good. Now I confess, I concede it was a tad of rub for her to do this. But why do you think about all the bad and don't remember the good? If you can't hate an Egyptian who afflicted and tortured, how much more so should you not have kindness against a fellow Jew who doesn't do you a favor? Okay, and to our final step, avoiding machlokas, critically important, and here I refer you to the book by Hanoch Teller, Courtrooms of the Mind, and that's the mitzvah of judging favor, being down the kaschos. What's the pasuk in the Torah? Whenever I ask this question, what's the pasuk in the Torah? Bidan lekavschos. Everyone says, Havidan chavercha lekavschos. Nice but wrong answer, because that's a mission in Pirkei Avos. The pasuk in Torah is Bitzedek tishpot amisecha, to give your fellow person, to judge your fellow person justly. Bitzedek. And the Gemara learns out in Shabbos and in Shavuos Daf Lamed, justly means to judge them fairly, to judge favorably. Davar acher, Havidan chavercha lekavschos, judge them favorably. Now, let's call a spade. It is hard to judge favorably. Natively, most of us are judgmental. Unless you're from the very, very small rear portion of the population. Like my wife, this is rather hilarious. She goes on the streets on Shabbos in Jerusalem. She sees cars driving. She goes, ay, vey, vey. Look at all these people going to the hospital. But if that is not your perspective, then we can share some good advice. How we down the cuffs close. Let me just establish in the beginning, it really is a matter of perspective, how we look at things. You know, there was a husband and wife that were driving along the access lane up to the highway, and as they were driving, they heard over the CB radio that a car was driving the wrong direction. They get onto the highway, and the husband turns to his wife and he says, look, it's not one car going the wrong direction, it's dozens of cars going the wrong direction. We can think we're right, indeed often we think we are, but in fact we can be mistaken. It's hard to separate ourselves from our perspectives because they represent ourselves. So then what we have to do is make this commitment to be down the kafschos, to make a commit, which reminds me of a story. Maybe some of you can relate to this. There was a frum lady who made a commitment to go on a diet, not tomorrow, but today. And as soon as she made the commitment to go on a diet, and she was driving down the road past the bakery, and there staring in the window was Napoleon, who was in custard. Knew, she said, must be Bashert. But then again, I did make this commitment to go on a diet, but then again, God did arrange this fortuitous encounter between the Claire and myself. I know. I'll wait for a sign from above. I know. If I find a parking space in front of the bakery, then I will know it's meant for me to eat the Napoleon. And sure enough, on her 14th time around the block, she found a parking space in front of the bakery. So we have to make a commitment in this regard. Now, we all know, everyone who attends Na'aleh knows, everyone knows, that there's a serious prohibition of Lashon Hara. We're not to gossip, to be smirched, to slander. But we also know, it's hard to refrain. It's hard to avoid doing it. And I would suggest even more difficult than the prohibition not to engage in Lashon Hara is the equally forbidden prohibition not to believe Lashon Hara. And how can we avoid Lashon Hara when it rings true and it makes sense? The answer, I believe, is the most puissant defense, most puissant and efficacious way to avoid Lashon Hara, indeed it is a guarantee, is to judge favorably. For if you judge favorably, you will never, ever, ever engage in Lashon Hara. It's a guarantee from Yishul Leib Gliskin. Okay, so let's just jumpstart this, because we could go and speak about this for hours, and I do this. And I must tell you, I've spoken about this in front of business audiences, and they nod their heads in agreement. Because I call this the courtrooms of the mind. Because you can condemn someone to life or sentence someone to 10 years over a simple misunderstanding. And whenever I speak from a business audience, they nod their heads in agreement. They are keenly aware of individuals whose careers have been destroyed over simple misunderstandings. So let's be down the cuffs. And my conclusion is that if you judge favorably, even though it sounds bizarre and strange, you think you know everything, more often than not, if you judge favorably, you have judged correctly. More often than not. Okay, so again, it's a hard thing to do, so we're going to jumpstart it, but what I want us to do is to realize we don't always hear things accurate. I'm giving you a tip how to get started in judging favorably, and that is we don't always hear things accurately. There are people like myself who speak quickly. There are people that have accents that are hard to decipher. Us Anglo-Saxons living in Israel are constantly, dynamically, perpetually giving Israelis a trial test of judging favorably because of our Hebrew. I'll give you an example or two or three. I had a student, a real Amerikansky Yankee Doodle. It was her first day in Israel. She had never been here before. She boarded a bus in Jerusalem, and a gentleman sitting next to the aisle was sneezing. And she said to him, Lehitraot, which means farewell. And he's sneezing away. She's going, Lehitra, Lehitra, Lehitra. Finally, she gets off the bus, and the bus driver waves to her, Labriut, which means Gesundheit. Or perhaps even better, there's a woman in my neighborhood living in Israel even longer than I, yet she hasn't yet quite caught the language. She walks into the fruit store, and I presume you know the word for peach in Hebrew is afarsek. She walked into the fruit store, and she said, "Ani rotza apikoris. I wish to purchase." Well, let's translate accurately. "I wish to purchase a heretic." He goes, "What? It's a new Tepikaris Gadol. And it's a from neighbor. I want, give me your biggest blasphemy." He said, "Thank God, lady. We're all out." And then there are times, that you hear everything. You know, let me just, I just thought of two other examples. Examples from my kids. One of my daughters was flown to America by her grandparents for her bas mitzvah. And I was speaking in Florida. She was in New York. And the last minute I had this idea to fly her down to Miami. I just realized that the story I'm about to tell you does not reflect well in my brilliance, but I've started, so I'll finish it. But I say, here's the story. I realized at the last minute that I can fly her down to Florida on mileage points, so I tell her, fly down to Miami, and I tell her, meet me at Avis Rent-A-Car at 7:30. Those are my instructions. 7:30, she's not there. I have her paged over the public address system, and they're paging and paging and paging. Can't find the girl, go back to Avis, back to the terminal. If you know anything about Miami International Airport, right here is Spanish, cucaracha, 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 cucaracha. Can't find the kid, can't find the kid, back to Avis, back to terminal. It's now 7:45, 7:50, now 8:30. I have to speak in North Miami Beach, and it's not around the corner. I didn't rent the car yet. 7:55, finally they give me permission to go to the gate. I punch in on the computer. Flight came in on time. She was on the flight, can't find the kid. Back to Avis, back to the terminal. If you know my Florida, everything's blast furnace heat, go outside, inside. 8:00, Shrek and a half, having a major anxiety attack, still can't find the kid. Back to Avis, back to the terminal. It's now 7:55, 7:50, Shrek. Here I take a little girl out of Jerusalem. I didn't give her any money, didn't give her a phone number. All I told her was, meet me at 7:30, Avis Rent-A-Car. Shrek and a half. It's now 7:45. People are waiting for me. I gotta go. How do I leave a little girl? I gotta go. I'm running out of the airport, Mike, and I hear, Mike, turn around and said, Sheva, where were you? He said, I went to the rent-a-car. It wasn't there. He said, what do you mean it wasn't there? He said, I went to the rent-a-car. It wasn't there. What do you mean it wasn't there? And she tells me, don't forget, this is an Israeli speaking. There's Hertz, budget, dollar, trifty. In a pizza place. We're talking, she's a Hertz, budget, dollar, trifty. And the pizza place. We're talking, show me, she shows me. Hertz, budget, dollar, trifty. And Avi's. And why should I be upset? Why is there any more Avi's than Avis? I mean, where else would we put a pizza place if not in a rental car? And if you miss one detail, you've missed the whole story. The other story I thought of, I was flying to Europe. I just got onto the plane. Ay, ay, ay. I remember something critically important I have to tell my wife. I called that, as soon as I landed, I called the house. Phone is ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. Finally, kid picks up the phone. If there's one thing I can't stand about Israeli mannerisms, I'm sorry. One thing I can't stand about mannerisms somewhere in the world is when a child answers the phone and says, Mize. Who's this? You make an erstwhile phone call, you get an interrogation. He said, Mize. I said, Mize? I said, Baruch Tzvi. This kid was 8 years old or maybe 6 years old, maybe. 9 years, between 5 and 10, this kid. So he said, Mize. So I said, Mize? He said, Brachtzvi. So then he said, Mize? I said, it's Abba. And he hangs up. I'm calling internationally, critically important call. Kid hangs up. I'm livid. I called again. This time my wife picks up. I said, you're not going to believe what's happened. No, you're not going to believe what happened. Phone is ringing and ringing and ringing. How do I explain this to you? Kid didn't even know that I had left. The majority of phone calls that come to my house are usually for me. And therefore, as a matter of expedience, I usually answer the phone. Kid picked up the phone. Didn't even occur to him that I could be calling from the outside. Once he turned the arms on the line, he hung up. And if you miss one detail, you've missed the whole story. And to conclude, I hope you don't mind, I set this story in New York City. A yeshiva man hailed a taxi to Park Avenue in the 30s. He asked the driver, take me up to the 90s. He got in the cab, opened his safer, began to ride uptown. They're riding uptown to come to 72nd Street. They're arrested at a red light. Just then, this fancy Delancey lady is crossing the street with the two poodles. At that very moment, a mounted officer is crossing the street on top of his horse. At that moment, At that moment, 72nd Street was stopped at a red light. Just then, this fancy Delancey lady is crossing the street with the two poodles. At that very moment, a mounted officer was crossing the street on top of his horse. When the poodles got loose, on the feet of horse, got nervous and up in the air, and the cop came crashing down on top of the taxi. That's the first scene. Next scene takes place 13 weeks later, and the Jew is suing the police department for damage he suffered inside the cab. The Jew is called to the stand. The judge says, please tell us your rendition. What happened, Your Honor? I hailed a taxi Park Avenue in the 30s, asked a driver to take me up to the 90s. I got in the cab, opened my book, began to study riding uptown. We come to 72nd Street, we're arrested at a red light. Just then, this fancy, delancy lady's crossing the street with the two poodles. At that very moment, when the poodles got loose, one on a feet of horse got loose, and up in the air, the cop came crashing down on top of the taxi. And Your Honor, which took such a jolt, I've been in pain ever since. I don't know what's going to be. Judge hears the man, then he calls the cop to the stand. Cops are talking about pipe betrayal. Just tell us what happened, Your Honor. It's exactly the way this fellow said. Judge said precisely. He said, well, there is one little detail he left. I said, what's that? He said, you see, after I got off the hood of the car, I went over and said, how are you feeling? He said, thank God, I'm fine, praise the Lord, thank God, just fine. And when the judge heard this, he began to scratch his chin and rub his hair. He called over the attorney from the jury and said, you know, I think your client is trying to pull a fast one in the police department. I think he's trying to squeeze them for money. Go back and ask, maybe there's some little detail he left out, something could change the entire story. So the lawyer goes back to the customer, to his client, and says, the judge thinks you're trying to pull a fast one. He's dubious of being above the bottom line. Maybe there's some little detail he left out, something could change the entire story. So the lawyer, the Jew said, well, then you better go back and testify. The little Yidla went back to him and said, Your Honor, this is what happened. I hailed a taxi Park Avenue in the 30s, asked the driver, take me up to the 90s. I got in a cab, opened my safe, my book, I began to start running uptown. We come to 72nd Street, we're stopped at a red light. Just then this fancy, delancy, schmancy lady is crossing the street with the two poodles. One was a white poodle, one was a black poodle. I cannot recall which is which. At that very moment, when the poodles got loose, when under feet of horse was gunners, went up there and the cop came crashing down on top of the horse. The cop came crashing down on the horse, landed on the car. Then, after the cop got to the hood of the car, so the poodle was crushed, moaning and groaning, fell bad for a poodle, took out his pistol, and shot the poodle dead. Then he saw the horse's front legs were broken. Fell bad for a poor horse, shot the horse. Then he came over and he said, I think I said, thank God, I'm fine, praise the Lord, thank God, just fine. Because if you miss one detail, you've missed the whole story. Let's go back one more time to the Gemara. The Gemara says in Shavuos, and since we're in Na'aleh, let's take out the Gemara, where we have everything here. The Gemara says in Shavuos, Lamed. Fish out those glasses. Oh, I think she was left lamb. Tanur Rabbanim, but Tzedek Tishpod Amisecha, Shlehei Echad V'Yoshev Echad Omed. The Gemara learns out, what does it mean the Pasuk says in the Kedoshim, judge your fellow person with justly. You should have one person standing and one person sitting. Echad medaber, kol tzor v'chad, omer lo kotzer. You couldn't have one person speaking the most protracted way and someone else is very brief in what they say. Dover acher, and yet another limud, b'tzeret yishvot amisecha, you should judge your fellow person justly. Have you done as chavercha l'kach schos? Judge your fellow person favorably. That's what the Gemara says. Then the Gemara says another thing, which the din is, eish is chaver kechaver. The law of the status of a wife of a Talmud Chacham has the same status as a Talmud Chacham. Eish is chaver kechaver. For example, Rabbi Heshi Reichman, who's obviously a big Talmud Chacham, if he were to walk in the room, you must stand up because mitnei seva tachum. If Rebbetzin Reichman were to walk into the room, for her too as well, you must stand up because of eish is chaver, the wife of a scholar, is like a scholar. That's what the Gemara says. Eish is chaver kechaver. And then the Gemara tells a story, as it often does. Whenever the Gemara tells, many times the Gemara tells you a din, and then it tells you a story to prove the law. The story is like this. Mrs. Rav Huna had a court case to be adjudicated by Rav Nachman. And so the judge, Rav Nachman, was worried. Once Mrs. Rav Huna walked into the courtroom, he'd be obliged to stand up for Mrs. Rav Huna, and her litigant might think that the judge is prejudicial. He stands up for her, he doesn't stand up for me, he likes her, prefers her, and therefore this may inhibit her ability to articulate her case, which could result in a travesty of justice, because by fulfilling this din of standing up for Mrs. Rav Huna, which is Eishes Chaver Kechaver, it could result in a travesty of justice. What was he to do? And he hit upon the following solution. He told a Talmud that as soon as Mrs. Rav Huna walks into the courtroom, I want you to throw a duck at my head, a duck, whack, whack. I'll be getting up ostensibly to get the duck off my head, but in fact, I'm getting up in honor of Mrs. Rav Huna. And I ask you, what in the world, what is the connection, what does that have to do with judging favorably? So Rav Eli Teitelbaum said a very nice insight. I think it's his idea. He said, would it ever occur to you, it's a lichtigkeit, would it ever occur to you, if you saw a Talmud walk in the Beis Medrash and throw a duck at the Rosh Yeshiva, would it ever occur to you that this is what the Rosh Yeshiva wanted? Just we don't know the whole story. You're missing one detail, you miss the whole story. How often does this happen? All the time. There's that connection. You miss one detail, and that's why you have to judge favorably. We think we know, there's always something we don't know. We don't know the mindset, we don't know how they were raised, we don't know their background, we don't know all these things, which components which make a person act one way, which we think is a different way. The policy we've adopted in my family is you look out the window, you see someone doing something strange, bizarre, peculiar, we always say, chapter 3, meaning, we just came in the middle, we didn't read the whole story, we didn't just start in the middle of the book, we didn't read the beginning. Or if you wish, act 2 of your culture, you can say the same thing. I heard this said in the name of Rav Schneer Kudler from Lakewood, but maybe the Chofetz Chaim said the same thing. You know, you go to yeshiva for Shabbos, you see they give this balabas aliyah and this balabas aliyah, they don't give the Rosh Yeshiva, they don't give a Rebbe. You say, what a chutzpah, where's the covered Talmud Chachamim? But you don't know those four. It could be that one got aliyah on Thursday, one had the Shabbos before. You don't know. That's chapter 3. You came in the middle. Okay, the rule of public speaking is tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them what you told them. We are, as we come towards the days of the 3 weeks, and we suffered, the bias was nechron because of sinas chinam. In the words of Rav Kook, we want to engage in ahavas chinam, to give love, and we proposed a peace plan, to tell a peace plan. Not with murders, never among ourselves, to avoid machloket and strife. We have several steps. Step number one is to adopt the words of Chafetz Chaim. Even if you're right, give in, and God will give you doubles. Secondly, the words of the Gemara in Ksubis, what you say should be pleasing to creation. It should be pleasing, not gratuitous, not hurtful, not spiteful. And you should establish a peace fund. In this way, you can avoid so many machlokot by giving money. Just allocate the money, and then it's not coming out of your pocket. It's been earmarked for peace. Then we had that there's lav in Torah, lo sasayich mitzri, don't hate an Egyptian, because you were strangers in their land. Simple kal v'chomer, a simple way of deduction. If you can't hate an Egyptian who afflicted and tortured and persecuted, how much more so not to bear a grudge against a fellow person who doesn't do you a favor? These things happen. And lastly, and very importantly, to give the benefit of the doubt. And Chazal teaches that the way you judge is the way you'll be judged. And if you give your fellow person the benefit of the doubt, then God will award you the benefit of the doubt. And I hasten to mention it applies not just to strangers, but even to family, to your spouse, to your children, to your parents, to your siblings, to your teachers, to your rabbis. And let us remember, the way you judge is the way that you'll be judged.